Thank you all for coming out. I'm going to read two short sections just to give you a sense of the range of the book and then the style of the language and things. In between which I'll talk very briefly about some of the sort of characters and themes, perhaps, in the sense of the book. But I'll just start off with this short piece. My daughter Zenobia's mother was a musician I met while I was at Berkeley. My ex-wife Helen was the first chair cellist for the San Francisco Symphony for 7 years. Now she gives private lessons and teaches at a boarding school. I can't say that our marriage, short as it was, or our falling in love was accidental or tragic, but I didn't see it coming. I was just admiring the way a good cellist can stretch a note, so unlike the sharp, concise quality of other instruments, like the piano. Helen played Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 for her thesis recital, and sitting in the front row of the auditorium, I felt, for the first and last time, the truest stirrings of something like love, or as close as I could get to it. It's true I should have known better. I work in lost time, in the lasting binds of history. I am surrounded by monuments and records of time and loyal remembrance. 3 years after that recital, I was away at a dig in Syria, dusting off a bit of papyrus, looking for an inscription when I realized I didn't want to go back. I remember sitting in the desert at night and looking back at my home, the little white walk-up we had in North Beach, San Francisco, with a small, common atrium space in back, lined with brick paths around roughly trimmed topiary, where Helen would practice afternoons and the group of elderly Italian ladies next door and across the way would clasp their hands together and shower her with gardenia petals. She would play little cuts of Verdi sometimes, and the ladies cooed like swallows in the fading light. I remember standing with my daughter clutching my finger in her tiny baby fist like it was an anchor to this earth, the sour, earthy smell of her chubby body. And I knew I shouldn't have been there. It should have been someone else in my place. I'd only seen my daughter twice in the last 6 years. I saw her briefly a few years ago in New York, and she stopped by my Princeton apartment for a night in 1991, when she was on her way to New Hampshire for a Grateful Dead show. Zenobia was a junior at Mount Holyoke then, studying English literature. She had two guys with her, skinny fellows with long hair and smelling strongly of incense and body odor, and they smoked pot all night. I made spaghetti and bread with some Chianti I brought back from Italy. She treated me almost like a stranger, and I guess I deserved it. I sat there in a chair while they smoked and talked and tried not to look at her too much. The two guys with her seemed to think what I did was interesting, but Zenobia just rolled her eyes whenever I spoke. Several times she deliberately mocked me, making fun of my current life, being deliberately cruel to me. But I didn't say anything about it. I wanted to do the right thing. I went to bed about 2 a.m, and I woke just about an hour later to the sound of my daughter screaming. I was halfway down the hall in my underwear before I realized it was the sounds of the three of them having sex. I went back to my room, and standing there in the dark, I concentrated on the hanging icicles outside my window. I felt dust collecting around my bare feet on the cold floor. I was beginning to understand the stillness of age and the slow slipping of time. I want to say that I wept all night, and that in the morning, I begged for her forgiveness and we were reborn, but I didn't. For most of the night, I looked at the faint city stars from my window, and pieced together my own constellations, Horus, Ra, Seth, Amun, Helen, even my daughter. She had a place there, faint, but still part of the order. In the morning they were gone, and a note was stuck to the fridge that said, "Thanks for the food and couch space, miss you, Zenobia." That's when I wept. The narrator of the third translation is a character named Walter Rothschild. He's an American Egyptologist working at the British Museum. He has an ex-wife and a daughter. The third translation itself, though, the title, refers to a particular piece of Egyptian statuary called the Stela of Passer. It's a funerary monument, sort of a tombstone-shaped thing, and it looks kind of like a crossword puzzle. What's interesting about it, when I was living in London, and spending time at the British Museum doing some research, I found out that they haven't yet solved this puzzle, the hieroglyphs themselves, because on the instructions it says this is due to be, this is supposed to be translated in three different ways. They figured out two ways, there's the vertical and the horizontal, you know, hieroglyphs can be read vertically and horizontally in both directions. But the third way they hadn't figured out yet. And so what struck me as interesting was what, you know, who has that job in the basement of the British Museum, lurking over this this ancient artifact that has stymied translators for, you know, over 3,000 years. It seemed to me that would be an interesting life to lead. The third translation also refers, though, to an ancient Egyptian concept of the third land or the third way, in that ancient Egypt was always divided into two lands. You know, the word Egypt in ancient hieroglyphs is actually the two lands, meaning the upper and lower reaches of the Nile. It was always divided. At various times in history, they were able to sort of bring the two lands together. But it became sort of a metaphor in Egypt. The third land was sort of this promised land, this place where the unification of Egypt, when everything was perfect. It also worked well with their belief system in the afterlife, this idea that there's the undead world and the living world, and the third land was the way between. So it seemed to me there was a natural sort of organic metaphor at work here with this third translation, and then how it would reflect upon the character of Walter Rothschild, the American Egyptologist, and in his present condition of his life with his ex-wife and daughter, who he basically abandoned at a very young age. Along the way, there's several other characters involved. One of the themes I was very interested in was this idea of obsession, a very sort of single-minded obsession. I've always found that compelling in characters, whether we're talking about Ahab or Jay Gatsby. I think obsession, single-mindedness, obsession in characters is a very fascinating thing for us to read about. Personally, I think it's because a lot of us wish that that's the way we could be. But we're not. We have a lot of other things in our mind, and we're not that singularly obsessed with something. So several of the characters kind of reflect this notion as well. And in particular, he has another American friend, and this next section I'll read is a lot about him. It's a guy named Alan Henry. He's a young man, very large guy with glasses, and he's American. And he's in London as well, living in the same building as Dr. Rothschild, apparently there to do some research on at the British Library on what he feels is a sort of unknown aspect of space travel. And so this next section, the short section here, is going to deal with that obsession. Just also, it'll give you a sense of some of the other tones of the book. I knew that Alan Henry preferred to do his reading in the rare book room at the British Library, where he would pore over